talking with Herbert G. Klein, former director of communications for the Nixon administration. Klein is out with a new book, making it perfectly clear, an inside account of Nixon's love-hate relationship with the news media. It's published by Doubleday. A little background about Herb. He's a veteran newspaper man, now editor-in-chief of the Copley newspapers in California, and for many years he was with the San Diego Union, then an association with Richard Nixon that spanned many years. Well, Herb, how did it all begin with Mr. Nixon?
Don, we first met when I got out of the Navy as a young reporter for a Copley newspaper, which the Alhambra Post Advocate, small daily in the suburbs of Los Angeles. Someone named Richard Nixon got out of the Navy and ran for Congress. I covered the race, and I became interested in the debates, of all things. He won the election with debates with the incumbent, who was H. Jerry Voorhees. We became friends after the election. We've been friends since.
And you're a longtime Republican.
Yes, I am. Although, when I first covered it, I really wasn't very political. I was more interested in sports. I'm still interested in sports, although I was never been able to follow up on my ambition to be a sports editor.
Tell me a little bit about that first campaign that you were involved in.
There are a lot of innuendos and I think a lot of false stories about the Nixon-Voorhees campaign. I recollected it, I think, quite well, but I also researched it very carefully in discussing this and other controversial episodes in this book regarding the press. Basically, the accusation is that this was an election based on Nixon trying to make Voorhees look like he was a communist and that communism was an issue. If you look at the newspapers in the area, it was not an issue. The issues were like those we have today. There were labor, unemployment, inflation, government regulation. They were bottom-line items which affected individuals. He campaigned hard. He surprised everyone. And he won, and from that time on, he emerged as a strong congressman.
But was Nixon misunderstood by the press in that campaign?
No, he wasn't. That's one of the interesting things. The press was very helpful to him. He met with them regularly. There were small papers. He dropped by the plants. I can remember taking him back to see the printers and talking with some of the shop foremen. And even in 1948, when I think the start of the disassociation with the press over the Alger Hiss case, he was a member, because Nixon was a member of the House Un-American Activities Committee. Many of the press were turned against Nixon because they thought that Hiss was right and Nixon had jobbed him. On the other side, some of the people who advised Nixon the most during that very critical period for a young congressman were newspaper men. Most prominently, I'd say, would be Bert Andrews, who was the prize-winning leading political correspondent for the New York Herald Tribune. From that point on, there was a love-hate relationship which varied over periods of years. You had new Nixons and old Nixons, Tricky Dick Nixons and Statesman Nixon. They all came because of how he did, where he made mistakes, how the press let its emotions go in, and sometimes where they covered things extremely well.
Of course, part of your job, I guess, was to try to set the record straight with regard to Nixon. For example, you wrote in your book about the rumor that, I guess it was on UPI, that Nixon was going to be campaigning in a Nehru jacket in 1968.
In 1968, I came back into the campaign arena after having been in the newspaper business solely from 1962 on. And as I was flying across the country to rejoin the campaign, I was wondering what was going to hit me first, but I never could have predicted the first question I got from a reporter. I got to my room in Key Biscayne. I had a phone call from a reporter who said he just picked up the rumor that Mr. Nixon was going to try to win the youth vote. He was going to wear a Nehru jacket. I didn't need to call a candidate, knowing that it was hard to get him to take his tie off. And so I denied it, and obviously it was right.
Then there was an earlier incident that took place in New Jersey in which Nixon refused to resign from what one newspaper called a Lily White Country Club.
The Ballestral Country Club.
How did you handle that?
Ballestral, as you recall, most recently has been in the news because it was the site of the U.S. Open, and it's been the site of the U.S. Open for several times. I think other than this one incident involving Mr. Nixon, and the only controversy has been over whether the greens are too fast for the professional champions who play golf on it. This was the kind of thing that came up entirely out of the blue. We went to at the invitation of New Jersey Republicans to a cocktail party with the idea of wooing the New Jersey delegation to support Mr. Nixon in the 1968 Republican nominating convention. As we went in, I saw a few pickets who had signs pertaining to Vietnam and nothing else. We got there, I found that someone had talked to the reporters and said that here was Mr. Nixon associating with a club which had a policy of, I suppose, a broad policy, but in fact had no members who were either Jewish or who were black. And the implication was if you went to a meeting at that particular place, and if you're a member of the club, which he was, therefore you're supporting such tactics. The way I handled it was to first have Mr. Nixon completely deny any feeling like that, which was easy enough for him to do. Secondly, it was his own decision whether he would resign from the club and therefore look like he was bowing under pressure or not. He didn't resign from the club till much later when the incident was quieted, and what we said then was he would try to handle it with working from within. What happened, though, a little incident like this, which came into the news out of the blue, caused us to step up our efforts as to what we're going to do to win the black vote. So as a result was that shortly thereafter, we began to work with Will Chamberlain, who came out for Nixon and would be obviously with his 6'7" or 7-foot frame, be someone very easily to recognize. And we did other things in trying to assure black voters that there was no feeling like this. We'd already been working with the Jewish voters, and I don't think that really was a question in their mind at all.
Nixon's career has been filled with dramatic moments, but perhaps one of the most dramatic was his famous 1962 news conference where he had lost the gubernatorial race to Brown, and he made those famous comments, "You won't have Nixon to kick around anymore," at a news conference. Now, what's the story behind that?
In making it perfectly clear, I've got a picture of Dick Nixon at the microphone looking unshaven, and Herb Klein standing in back looking like he's representing the California prune industry. I really felt bad, and I guess I've never felt more dramatically bad at a moment, because what had happened was that we lost election to Governor Brown, lost it by a couple hundred thousand votes. He had wanted to turn in his cards the night before, and I recall 1960, and so I talked him into waiting till the morning, and the press by that time had gone past deadlines anyway. In the morning when I went in with Bob Finch and Bob Holliman to see him, first thing he said to me, "I don't want to go down and face the press." And I said, "We don't think you should, and you haven't had any sleep all night. I'll handle it, and why don't you go on home?" And that's where we left it. He talked to a group of the workers, and it became a very emotional scene. Women were sorry, you know, they've lost, and it's been an all-out thing. An Italian television producer was very emotional, started crying on his shoulder, and coupled with us, two very old friends came up and said, "Dick, you got to go down and face him." I'm down there, meanwhile, having a press conference. I might say there were some episodes in my book that were hard for me to write. This was one because it was still painful. I was explaining that we felt that the Bay of Pigs had blocked off changing voters, and we perhaps had been wrong in emphasizing local issues more and this type of thing. And all of a sudden, I see Bob Holliman over at the edge waving at me. I promptly announced that Mr. Nixon had left and going on home, and then I heard applause, and the next thing I knew, there was someone tapping me on the shoulder and proceeding to say, "Now that Mr. Klein has talked to you, I have a few words to say." That's the real story of what happened, and in making it perfectly clear, what I've tried to do is look at the role of the press, how it's chronicled things, and international events, how I think it's really part of the action today, and look at it in a way which recalls history through anecdotes and personal experiences, but I think also sheds a lot of light on the tremendous power that the press has in the election we're in today, and it's going to have during this entire decade of the 80s.
Well, Nixon obviously was very bitter about the press's role in that 1962 gubernatorial campaign.
He was very bitter, and he's been bitter to press a great number of times. He was in 1960 also. In 1962, I've gone back and tried to look at the thing again in the light of being away from the campaign, and I have to say I disagree with him. The press basically was quite fair, and I could name the reporters who covered him, and they're fair, I think they're friendly, and there was no reason to feel that way. But what happens to a candidate, and I think you see it with Mr. Carter now, he's disinclined to be with the press as much because he's finding that you get a little more thin-skinned as the criticism grows, and it's not just Mr. Carter, you can trace it to every president, including Mr. Kennedy, who was the most popular with the press and who suddenly became disillusioned with him.
Perhaps we ought to stay away from the current campaign for equal time purposes.
Yeah, well, I'm not trying to judge it. I'm talking about the events. But just to finish the point,
sure.
I think there were one or two reporters. One of them was a reporter for the Los Angeles Times who the president felt were unfair. They were controversial reporters who raised questions which he thought were unfair. So it was really based around one or two people, not the California Press Corps, which brought on this feeling and brought on this tremendous outburst of denunciation by Mr. Nixon.
Of course, even one or two adverse comments in a given news media can bring the walls tumbling down on the whole industry to a certain degree. We hear a lot about the role of the Eastern establishment news media, for example. As if everybody is painted with the same brush.
Mr. Agnew used to emphasize that, and at one point he said that, he and Bob Haldeman both in speeches at different times said that it really was controlled by a small elite group in New York, which you got the impression that they get together on Sunday afternoon over either tea or cocktails and determine them what the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the three networks were going to do in concert. We know that while they see each other a lot, they certainly are in competitive situations and out to beat each other. I think there is a problem, though, to look at, and that is that the newsmen too much concentrate on what they know and hear in New York and Washington, and the feeling that you might find in these two cities is far different than you find in other cities in the country. And it's different in Chicago than it is in Houston or Los Angeles, for example.
Herb, on January 27, 1969, Nixon held his first news conference as president. Obviously, his last news conference was, there was no such thing. How did this first news conference as president contrast with that last news conference in California?
Entirely different, Don. It was one he was prepared for, one he talked on substance. He knew the subjects that he was going to be asked about. He wanted to get into them. I think he opened a great door for himself to have an entirely new relationship with the press, which would have lasted much longer than the normal honeymoon had he allowed it to do so. It was one which the most critical reporters I mentioned in my book, Mary McGrory, who's a liberal columnist who writes beautifully, and she had only great praise for it. That's the kind of opportunity a president has if he will seize it. What happened wrong with us is that that worked swell, and then another one was not quite as good, and pretty soon the press conferences became spaced further apart, and the antagonism from within the White House toward the press grew to far too great a degree.
But why? Why did this happen?
It happened because, first, the president was thin-skinned. Secondly, you had and you normally have this. It's true of White House staffs. Most people really know nothing about either press or public relations, but because they're in the public arena, they all fancy themselves as knowing it all. And you have too many people who are experts in it. I have a chapter on PR experts. PR experts in my chapter are the inexperts who all feel that because the president pays attention to this, that they ought to. I think a problem is that a president has to communicate if he's to govern the people. He's puzzled as to how he communicates in a meaningful fashion, and he's badly hurt if he feels that the correspondents criticize him, or in the case of the most bombastic thing that happened to Mr. Nixon when he made a speech in November of, I believe it was 1970, on Vietnam, and a very important speech. He found the networks coming on to rebut him rather than to interpret him. When that happens, you build a growing Berlin Wall between the newsmen and the press. The president makes a mistake if he doesn't recognize it's going to happen, if he doesn't prepare to deal with it by working more closely with the press, and if he pulls away. But inevitably, presidents do, and all you have to do is look at modern history since Franklin Roosevelt's time.
All administrations. Truman had a tough time with it. Johnson certainly did.
Yeah, and each one treated it differently. Truman's idea that he didn't care about publishers or editors, neither did Franklin Roosevelt. He just wanted to be friends with the reporters. He didn't like most of the reporters, but he had his handful where he could have them. His press relations would be to play poker with a few of them. Herbert Hoover's was that he would play golf with four of them. I think that Lyndon Johnson's problem was that he became overly familiar with them, and so that he had two wire service machines in the Oval Room. He had three television sets. I'm not sure when he had time for a lot of the other decisions, because he was watching all the news, and when he didn't like it, I would rush out and call a reporter and tell him he didn't like it.
I'm Don Swaim in New York, and you're listening to Crosstalk. With me is the former Director of Communications for the Nixon administration, Herbert G. Klein. Herb, H.R. Haldeman, of course, was the strongman in the Nixon administration, and obviously when the breach between Nixon and the press began to widen in the 70s, Haldeman set out to do something about it. What?
Well, Bob Haldeman, who was H.R. Harry Robert for Haldeman, I think set out to keep the press and the White House further apart. He felt that the way to deal with it was to have the president speak directly to the people through television and radio, mainly, in addresses and occasionally with a specific interview. But mainly, he also set out to see that the news media were given fairly little in the way of information from the routine sources you'd have in a White House staff. Obviously, Ron Ziegler would have daily briefings and would work with the press with his staff of Jerry Warren and the others. My job was to try to deal with not only the information processes of the government, but in this kind of a hostile atmosphere with newsmen in Washington and all the way across the country. When you've got a them versus us philosophy pervading in the White House, and this was developed by Bob Haldeman, but with considerable encouragement from the president. He wouldn't have done it without that kind of encouragement. It becomes a difficult thing. It hurts the White House, and in effect, it's not good for the press, because the press then would adopt the same attitude. And so instead of having an adversary relationship, which is, I think, healthy, you have an antagonistic atmosphere, which is unhealthy for the information product to reach the American people.
Herb, but you write that between 1968 and 1974, Vice President Agnew was the most controversial figure in the Nixon administration, and you're cross to bear. I understand that you introduced him initially as Spyro, is that right?
Or I did.
Red faces when that happened?
You know, I smile when I read about someone putting his foot in his mouth, because I've been among them. One of my prize ones was meeting Agnew for the first time after Mr. Nixon had decided he was his choice for vice president, talking to him for 10 minutes, trying to brief him on what happens when you first face a national press. You know, his national press up till then had been four reporters from Baltimore. Probably you were one of them, Don, at that point. And you come into this vast swarm, and so I didn't bother to find out how to pronounce his first name. I said, ladies and gentlemen, I wanted to introduce you to the man who's been chosen by Mr. Nixon as the one he would hope would be nominated for vice president, Spyro T. Agnew. Agnew, I have to give him credit, responded in a quick fashion. He said, well, I realize that I'm not exactly a household name.
Well, he did become a household name after he used phrases like fat Jap in referring to a Baltimore Sun reporter. He made his famous slum remark and the anti-TV remark. What did you do to try to counter some of the uproar that Agnew produced? I understand you considered resigning after the Agnew TV speech.
I did. After the Agnew TV speech, which is, let me talk about both sides because they're two different questions. One is the inadvertent remarks, and I think he's treated unfairly on the Fat Jap remark. You know from Baltimore that people kidded this reporter, who was a good reporter, in that fashion. It was not a racial remark in any way, and it was a kidding remark, which was brought into the political arena at the time when Mr. Agnew went into Hawaii, where Japanese food is very, very important. I think the lesson to be learned there, and other candidates have gone through the same thing, is that something which may be trivia can become a major issue because in some cases the reporters are bored. They don't have anything else to write about at that point. We've seen a lot of uproar in this campaign on the KKK remark or something of this kind, which aren't really major issues in deciding who is going to be the president one way or the other. The other side is the major thrust of the Agnew attack on broadcast in the first speech and on the newspapers in the second in Des Moines. I felt it was wrong. I thought we were taking the wrong tactics, and I was not aware that the first speech was going to be delivered until Mr. Agnew was on an airplane en route to Des Moines to do so. I guess inadvertently I got the wrong speech more publicity than I would have liked, because I felt it was a responsible thing was to inform the networks and the leading news bureaus that this was what Agnew was going to say. When the networks received the text, they got into a great uproar as to whether or not they should broadcast it or not. They weren't prepared to do it. The result is they made the decision to do so. Mr. Agnew, for the first time in his life, was broadcast in primetime live from Des Moines, making this attacking speech. And in effect, the network's effort to put this side forth led to the major attack on them by people who believed it's in Mr. Agnew that they were being treated unfairly. I think you don't win by that kind of an attack. I'm not saying that the networks have always been fair. I think they've been unfair on many occasions. I think basically, though, that the effort is to do a good job by newsmen. And when we get into this kind of a squabble, which takes away from the elements of news which are important, it ends up in a detrimental fashion.
Herb, I want to jump ahead a little bit because I want a little time to ask you about this. You left the administration in 1973, and obviously you were engaged in a power struggle with Haldeman and Ehrlichman and perhaps Ziegler. What happened?
I'd announced in 1971, late I think, and in 1972, that I was going to leave in some point in 1973 because I had a basic desire to go back to you and my other colleagues in the news business. That's my life, although I say that I don't regret a bit being in government and serving them in campaigns. I hope more newsmen will do so. What happened, though, was not exactly as I'd planned it. After the 1972 election, I recount in the book from my own notes, I went into a meeting expecting to hear Mr. Nixon come in and congratulate us on our great campaign effort, and he did so for about 1 minute and launched in what was called a burning embers speech. We talked about looking at philosophy and that people burn out after so many years, and therefore he felt it was important to get some new people in. Would we all submit our resignations? That brought a pretty deadly silence, I can assure you, and Bob Haldeman then followed up to tell us how we should do it. I resigned, as I had just a few key senior members of my own staff do. I spared the others. And then I went on a few days vacation because I traveled 60,000 miles to a campaign forum. I was called to return and to go, like a great number of us, to Camp David. I think I called in my book the equivalent of sort of a political a death march and a baton. Well, I went up, and Mr. Nixon seemed to think that I'd been briefed on the plans and said that he was going to curtail the duties of my office, and would like it if I would consider becoming the director of the USIA or the ambassador to Mexico. I came up there prepared to tell him how he could make better use of the office, how we could strengthen, how we could do a better job in providing information for him and the American public. It was a stunning moment.
He didn't want to hear that.
He didn't want to hear that. He didn't know, I think, how badly I felt. In writing a book, and this is my first book, this was the hardest part for me to write of all. I mentioned the 1962 convention. I waited till the last and then wrote this part because it took me that long to get over the wound of it. The fact was, shortly thereafter, a lot of Watergate troubles began to develop.
I was going to say, you missed it. You missed Watergate. In a way, you were...
Well, it had happened, and I stayed on until after, because they needed so much help. I stayed on until after Haldeman and the others had resigned, and everyone knew that, obviously, I was a combatant. I was not a part of it. But from then on, after this announcement, the dramatic announcement, the effort was to try to get me to stay. And I had made up my mind that I was going to, and I knew I had a lot of fortunate offers. And so that's the story.
Do you still have contact with Richard Nixon?
Yes, I do. I see
what
him occasionally.
It's
a friendly relationship. We don't see each other often. I admire him greatly for what he's done in foreign policy, and I recognize the weaknesses, which I depict in the book also. And so that I didn't confer with him when I was writing the book because I wanted to have the feeling I was writing it from my own notes and my own feelings without having anyone influence me one way or the other. When it was finished, however, I went down and talked to him about it. He knew I'd been working on it, and we exchanged some research material and had a very nice discussion about it. And sometime in the next few days, I expect to deliver a copy of it to him.
What about some of the other figures in the Nixon administration? You, for example, I know were close with Haldeman at one time. Apparently, there was some sort of falling out there as Haldeman was able to become more entrenched in the Nixon administration. Do you still maintain a relationship with these former Nixon people?
Some I do, some I don't. I do see Bob Haldeman occasionally. There was a dinner given by Bob Finch, who is one of my heroes in the book, just as Chuck Colson is clearly the number one villain in the book. Bob Haldeman attended the dinner. It was like 30 businessmen, and wrote some kidding things. I mean, I think that Bob was well-meaning, patriotic, intelligent. He didn't understand the use of power and how he abused it. He abused the power, and I think recognizes that as a fact now and is doing very well.
We have only about, less than 60 seconds, but perhaps you can truncate your comment. You did play a role in some of Colson's so-called dirty tricks in 1970 involving the campaign of Joseph Tidings, and you say you're sorry you did that. What did you do?
Well, I played a very minor role, didn't realize exactly what he was up to. It was difficult to know what Colson was up to any time. My role was he put together some notes he assured me were factual. He wanted them to be delivered in a way which might interest some major magazine of doing an article. Life did such an article, and it was very detrimental to Tidings. They researched it themselves, but I was wrong in believing Colson, and I was wrong many times in believing him. I learned not to believe him.
Very quickly, are you sorry you ever got involved in politics?
Not at all, and I would hope that more young people would come in. I would hope that more newsmen would come in, because you see a part of life in government and world policies you won't find out about it any other way.
On Crosstalk with me, Herb Klein, author of Making It Perfectly Clear, an inside account of Nixon's love-hate relationship with the media, published by Doubleday. I'm Don Swain.